Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
We live in the shadow of crime, resigned to be the victims of fear, of violence, of social impotence.
You step outside, you risk your life. You take a drink of water, you risk your life. And nowadays you breathe, and you risk your life.
The dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street, and there's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it.
That is why we distance ourselves. That's why we make jokes. We don't do it because it's fun. We do it so we can get by. And sometimes because it's fun.
Your levity is good. It relieves tension and the fear of death.
Ladies and gentlemen, fellow slaves of the plantation, welcome to the Vinny Eastwood Show. It's Vinny with a Y because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinny Eastwood Show. The only thing worse than the truth is Vinny's jokes.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode full of all that Vinny Eastwood goodness I know you have been craving. You know, when you go past the Vinny Eastwood aisle at the supermarket and you're like, oh, I really want some of that, but it'll be so bad for my thighs. My very special guest joining me today is Phil McCabe, coming at us from Raglan, the pseudo surf capital of New Zealand, where cafes and surfwear are the mainstay, as well as beer and sport. Now, we are talking about something very important, which maybe some New Zealanders aren't overly aware of. It's seabed mining. Now, maybe of news to people that this actually hasn't happened before, where they've been mining the seabeds per se. And Phil McCabe here from kasm.org.nz has come on very graciously to tell us all about it. Phil, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. Thanks for inviting me.
So it's a new game, the seabed mining, is it?
Yeah, it's a new activity, a new commercial activity being lined up for our oceans, not only in New Zealand but around the world. And it really hasn't, you know, the rubber hasn't hit the road yet. Pretty much every developed nation is looking at seabed mining and developing their programs. Large corporations are throwing money at exploration in various areas. And New Zealand's pretty much ahead of the pack as far as seabed mining proposals and the development of those proposals.
Ahead of the pack, maybe in an ironic format, because in some ways seabed mining is a big step backwards, isn't it?
I think a lot of us would agree with that statement. Yeah, it's not really taking into account, you know, the damage we've done to the planet over the last 150, 200 years or more. And it's, you know, it's inherently a destructive activity, and that's something you can't get around. And you know, with the current state of our oceans, already in really serious trouble, imparting a new activity on the marine environment that guarantees further destruction is definitely a backward step in my view.
And in terms of mining minerals from the seafloor, this hasn't been done before, so there's actually no telling what the consequences might be potentially, is there?
Yeah, the new iterations of this idea, mining the seabed, you know, the scale of it is phenomenal. You know, the scales they're talking about is phenomenal. There is one operation off the coast of Namibia in quite deep water in a totally different environment, and they're mining diamonds there, and they have been for 20 years or so. But there's very little information relating to the environmental effects of that, and so we don't have a track. There's no track record. There's no precedent as far as what the effects are.
Now, there's also a lot of international attention that's now being brought onto the issues, because New Zealand's not the only place that this is being proposed. In fact, it's being proposed in a lot of different places, and it's got this sort of momentum from it and this attention from business and government.
Yeah, so the UN, the United Nations, set up a body some years ago called the International Seabed Authority. That's the ISA, and they've been charged with drafting regulations and laws and managing exploration permits and that sort of thing. They're still in the process of drafting the international laws. That's for waters outside of countries' territories, so they call it the high seas or international waters. And the ISA is managing that. They've already released in the Pacific alone 1.5 million square kilometres for exploration, and that's in the Pacific outside of countries' territorial waters and exclusive economic zones. So the scale, as I said, the scale is phenomenal. Greenpeace, when I first got involved in this about 5 years ago, I did a lot of research, and Greenpeace hasn't really haven't addressed it per se, but they did look at it some years ago, and they are we are collaborating with Greenpeace to a degree on current applications. But there was a statement on the Greenpeace International website that said seabed mining could have the largest aerial impact of any human activity. It's quite significant. So the ISA is managing, they're doling out international permits for international waters, and every major country is putting their hand up and claiming areas of the ocean for mining minerals.
Now, how many are we talking about here? Like, which countries are we talking about? Like the major Western nations, that kind of thing?
Major Western nations, India, China, Japan, everyone basically. Our lawyer who represents us, our main lawyer, he's been involved with the ISA and going to meetings and helping to draft, attempting to include some responsible sort of components to the laws that are being drawn up, and he's constantly moving around the globe talking to different at various meetings, and he's just come back from Belize a couple of weeks ago, where he was having a workshop with several Caribbean nations about how they, because all these countries are being courted, if you like, by large industry, think Lockheed Martin. And large industries and saying, seabed mining will provide economic salvation. And, so he's going around, talking to governments and bodies, how to enable them to do, if they're going to approach this, to do it in a responsible way.
Now, we've got so many of them looking into it and considering the environmental impact of its potential being, as you say, the largest area of effect that humans have ever done, and everybody's doing it. That kind of seems like global catastrophe to me.
It's pretty bloody scary, Vinny, I tell you. Yeah, it's full on.
What percentage of the world survive on the ocean, the bounty it provides?
Yeah, I mean, the oceans are the lungs. It's like the rainforest. The oceans are the lungs. With this massive, oxygen carbon transfers. The bounty, as you say, the sea life that we provides us nutrients to stay alive is phenomenal. But as an overall ecosystem, the oceans are incredibly important for climate stability and all that sort of thing. So, we know everywhere, every second day you're hearing reports of the sorry state that the oceans are in already. So, yeah.
Now, Phil, your webcam seems to have malfunctioned a little bit. If you wouldn't mind, just clicking that little webcam button on and off again, that should usually fix it. But In terms of New Zealand, its landmass, it's actually quite small, it's even smaller than Great Britain, but it's got actually quite a massive exclusive economic zone surrounding us, up to 200 nautical miles, and that's like 1% of planet Earth, right?
Yeah.
And they're talking about opening just that up to mining.
Yeah, our exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, it's, you know, you could call it our marine estate. You know, that's our place. That's what we're responsible for. We're responsible for looking after it, and we're also responsible. I mean, we can gain benefit from it, and we do multiple different benefits. But it's the fifth largest EEZ in the world, and yes, it covers about 1% of planet Earth, and it's 20 times our land area, so it's a massive area. And the government through the Foreshore and Seabed Act in 2004, the Labor government sort of, you know, if you recall, there was a national discussion that went on in 2004 saying, you know, don't give the Foreshore and Seabed to Māori because they'll block access to the beaches and blah blah blah. But the real underlying thing there was that the government was claiming ownership of the seabed. And therefore they could then sell off rights to extract minerals and oil and gas, and which is what they're doing. So within maybe 4 or 5 weeks of that law being enacted in early 2005, the first prospecting permit for seabed mining was issued for an area covering thousands of square kilometres directly off the coast of Raglan. You can't even get a permit to extend your deck at home within 4 or 5 weeks, you know, but the government processed and issued an exploration or a prospecting permit within a number of weeks. So, you know, it was a predetermined thing. And also back in 2004, seabed mining companies were registering in New Zealand, in anticipation of the law going through. So, you know, that's the foundation of it in New Zealand. And since then, the National Party, our right wing government, has ramped up that whole agenda of exploiting the mineral wealth or the mineral resources that we have in our marine estate. And, well, and you know, there is a
marine estate. I think they opened up, I don't know, off the top of my head, like 18 regional parks to mining or consents or prospecting or some ridiculous number.
Phenomenal agenda from the government over the last sort of 9 years, you know, just blatantly going against what most New Zealanders, would like to see and opening our land and our marine estate up for mining and oil and gas. I mean, 2 weeks ago, I think it was, the minister released half a million square kilometres in the block offer program they do each year for exploration, and it's phenomenal. But anyway, so the government agenda is absolutely to see a seabed mining industry set up within New Zealand waters, and it's along the west coast of the North Island. There's also been an application which we fought and managed to get declined off the east coast of the South Island on the Chatham Rise, which heads east of Christchurch out to the Chatham Islands, the whole west coast from Whanganui all the way to Cape Reinga was under exploration permit out to 12 nautical miles plus bigger areas outside that 12 nautical mile line, and it's a big concern that we have is that there hasn't been a national discussion around this, that the general public isn't aware of it. And, you know, I continually say that we are an island nation full of coastal people who love the marine environment, and we have deep connections to the marine environment, you know, and it's these proposals are so offensive that it just, anyone that hears about them, and I've spoken to thousands of people, and I can count on one hand the number of people that have said, oh, that sounds like a good idea, you know. literally, 99 point whatever percent are just going, shaking their head, saying that, no, that can't be true.
Well, that's the problem, that when you have an informed population, there's a lot of things that you just can't do anymore. Now, your webcam also needs to just be reset again. And if it happens again, I'll just say webcam and just click it on and off.
Sure.
All right. Now, considering this is the Seabed Miner's third application that they're sitting on right now, did you by chance have a hand in getting their other two applications scrapped?
Yeah, so Chasm, Kiwis Against Seabed Mining, that's the organisation that I am the chairperson of and have been working with for the last 5 years or so. The organisation was set up in 2005 in Raglan, and that was a direct result of local iwi being approached by the company and they had to be consulted with, and the iwi brought it to the Raglan community, and a couple of full house public meetings ensued, and Chasm was formed from those meetings back in 2005. In 2012, we did hear of a company that was advancing their proposal to where they would actually be putting an application in, and that goes into the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority. And late 2013, they lodged that application. We had run a coastal campaign through 2012 and 2013, raising awareness from Whanganui to Piha, and we travelled that coast several times, including a famous surfer paddling a 17-foot surfboard for 500 kilometres up the coast. As a result, when the company put their application in, we had 4,500 submissions, which was three times what the EPA had ever received on any other application for anything else. So, you know, a lot of public outcry there, and 99.5% of those submissions were opposing the application. Chasm worked with local iwi, Ngāti Ruanui, and a couple of other iwi down the coast, and we worked alongside even the fishing industry to challenge that application, and it was declined in 2014. And straight on the back of that, there was a Chatham rock phosphate, so a rock phosphate that sits on the bottom of the ocean in about 500 metres depth on the Chatham Rise, which is essentially a mountain chain that runs east of Christchurch, and phosphate is used as a fertiliser in farming. They wanted to mine initially a 10,000 square kilometre area, and they reduced that to a 5,000 square kilometre area, we fought that as well alongside Greenpeace and Ngaitahu, the South Island iwi, as well as the fishing industry and also the Chatham Islands community, and that got declined as well in 2015. So two out of two applications, put forward and declined, and this is under legislation that was written up by a government that wants to see this activity happen, right? So it was legislation that was written to enable it. And these companies spent 7, 8, 9 years developing their proposals. They spent between them, it was about $100 million between the two of them. And still the applications got denied. So what that tells me is that the activity itself is so inherently destructive that it's inappropriate. At this time, you know, in 2016, it's inappropriate. 2017, it's inappropriate and unacceptable to a lot of people. So the first application, that we fought and got declined, that same company has come back and they reapplied in September last year, and we're still in the EPA hearing process about that. And that application is a 65 square kilometre mine, which is a pretty big area, and they want to mine 50 million tonnes of seabed sediment every year. And 10% of that sediment is iron ore, so it's the black part of what we see on our west coast beaches, and that's iron ore, and that would be separated out and shipped off straight to Asia. Direct export, not coming to land and creating jobs and that sort of thing, just getting straight direct export. And then the other 90% of that 50 million tonnes per year gets dumped back over down a pipe and into the ocean, and a lot of that material gets sort of pushed along by currents and wave action, creating a big plume which damages the surrounding area from the mining site.
A phrase just popped into my head. Are we in fucking Uganda? Like, bro, what?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's ludicrous. And in the company, I mean, you know, it's what they do. They sort of underplay the effects and they overstate the economic benefit. There's only one reason that we as a nation should even consider this, and that's money, right? I mean, who doesn't like a bit of money, right? You know, it helps us do stuff. The whole communication coming from the company is it's only 50 million tons a year. It's only 65 square kilometer area. That's nothing, you know, when you look at the size of the ocean. But you know, and then they talk up the jobs that would be created and the economic benefits. It's pretty bizarre.
As Bill Hicks said, if there's anybody listening and you're in advertising or marketing, kill yourself. Yeah. And that's basically what's going on here, is just advertising and marketing in order to sell a product to the government so that they can reap a profit from it. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, it's not selling a government for a profit. It's what lies at the bottom of our oceans is a bunch of stuff that can be turned into money. Yeah, I mean, that, look, straight up, that is something that could occur. And who owns that? Under current law, all New Zealanders own that, 100%. And these companies or the economic sort of model that our government is using is to charge these companies something in the range of 2% of the value of the resource for them to extract it and to sell it. And 2%, 2 cents on the dollar. That isn't very smart economics from my perspective.
That sounds almost exactly the amount that they were pitching that the South Island, I think it was, what was his name, Tim Shadbolt, tried to broker a deal where we get up to 4 cents a barrel of oil that they're pulling out of the ocean, and that was when it was like selling for nearly $111 a barrel.
Right, right. What do you say, 4 cents a barrel?
Something around those lines, you know.
Yeah. So I mean, it's. I don't get the government's desire. I just don't understand their thinking behind it. You know, it may be that them. I mean, it's a bizarre process personally to go through. I'm an ocean lover. You know, I'm a surfer. As I look above the screen here, I'm looking out to the ocean, looking up the west coast toward Auckland, and it's you know, my life revolves around the ocean, and coming to terms with walking along the beach and thinking about the stuff that I'm walking on as an economic resource rather than as sand, you know, it's sort of a strange process to go through over a period of time, and actually looking into trying to get your head around what the thinking is behind all this. And, you know, it's a bizarre one. But you know, there's people in New Zealand and around the world that want to, you know, that think that money's, you know, hold money in a high regard. And we do have to, you know, in this day and age, we need to be able to think about it and respond intelligently. And so that, you know, we can argue it. And there may or may not be a way to do this in an environmentally sustainable way, in a socially, culturally sustainable way or acceptable way. But what's being proposed at the moment is definitely not. You know, it's large scale. It's bulk commodity. It's no added value on land to our people, you know. So, yeah, I don't know. I can't remember what your question was, mate, but.
There was a concept in economics long ago called natural capital. Let's say you're walking along a street and it's got ancient trees in that street and a natural stream that's actually running down or something like that, and it's been preserved.
It's got value,
inherent value right there in it. And the same could be said of the seabed at the moment. There could be scallops down there. There could be all sorts of what the Māori call kaimoana. And also, I found out the Maori word for food made with weed was kai marijuana. I'm just going to go mad at it now.
Drop it in there, bro. Yeah.
But speaking of which, we're talking about the very process by which our natural capital actually gets protected. There's indeed a framework, okay? And that framework is supposed to run thusly, right? There's a whole bunch of rules and things of that nature, a process to follow. Is it actually being followed in this case with the mining and seabed? Because you're talking about things that are being approved very, very quickly, which leads me to believe that they were in the plans long before the legislation even came into the framework. So this is a long game that we're actually looking at here, and by what means has the process been corrupted in order to expedite what people clearly don't want?
Yes. Yeah, so what's your question?
What process is there supposed to actually be to protect the environment, and how has it been corrupted?
Okay, so there's the EEZ legislation. Exclusive Economic Zone and Extended Continental Shelf Act, right? And that was put in place in 2013 so that these types of applications outside our 12 nautical miles, so just to go back a little bit, from shore to 12 nautical miles is called our territorial seas, and that is administered under the Resource Management Act, the RMA, right? So basically what goes on land, the same laws that apply on land apply out to 12 nautical miles. From 12 nautical miles out to the 200 nautical mile line, and in some cases beyond that, because we're actually on a continental shelf here, so they include the continental shelf as part of our EEZ, that law was put in place in 2013. We've had two applications, and two of them have been denied, so that and rightly so. And that tells me that the legislation is reasonably robust. And straight after those two applications were denied, the mining lobby group Stratera lobbied the government to change the laws for a few changes. One of the main ones being that the minister gets to choose the people that sit on the panel and make the decision, rather than them being an independently appointed panel. So, that law change hasn't occurred yet, but it's in the pipeline. Under that legislation, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority, administers, basically processes an application, and any human being on planet Earth can write it. If someone puts an application in, anyone can write a submission in favor saying, yes, I like the idea, go ahead, or stop. We don't like it, and oppose it. So that's good. We're lucky in New Zealand that we have that. There's lots of places in the world that don't have that right, that public right to engage in a process. So the EPA, basically the company has to put all their information in at the beginning, and then they have numerous scientific experts, they have a legal team, and then submitters have the opportunity to just sort of put a written submission in and say, I don't like it for this reason and this reason, or they can go beyond that and speak at the hearing. They can say that, and then they can go and speak to the committee at the hearing, or they can engage more fully, such as the way that CASM has, and we've employed scientists and a legal team and an economist to argue against what the company's put forward in their application. And so it's a pretty robust process. It's a pretty good process as far as I'm concerned. This time round, though, the second time round with the same company, it feels very much like there has been some downward pressure from the minister or the government to get this application over the line. And for example, the EPA, the company said, here's our application. It's got something like 3,000 pages. And in these 190 pages, we want to black some sections out. And people can look at them if they sign a confidentiality agreement. And we're like, what? Wait a minute. This is a public process, a transparent process. That's not okay. So we said to the EPA, that's not okay, you need to release that information, and they said no. So we took them to the Environment Court, which is a court above the EPA level, and the Environment Court overturned it and made the company release that information. So that was
overturned it after having to go through the effort and the expense of challenging something that they were trying to do that was clearly illegal.
Yeah, yeah. And the EPA allowed it. So that was number one. There's been several sort of other issues that have come up that have been not really fair play, you know, whether they're actually illegal or it's just sort of subtle bias or less than subtle bias or, you know, just not quite a level playing field. There's been several things that have come up through the couple of months of the hearing. But then last week the EPA put out an order that said, that the company, that they want the company to go away and get a whole bunch of more information, and they want the EPA staff to help them collate that information. And we're like, wait a minute, you want the EPA, the authority, to help the company get more information, information that should have been there at the beginning of the hearing or when they first put their application in. You know, so you can't bring in new information halfway through a process. So anyway, we're just about to address that issue, or we've just addressed that issue.
Now, you've submitted a petition to Parliament, haven't you?
We have, yeah. Just prior to their application going in, we submitted a petition calling for a moratorium on seabed mining in New Zealand waters, and that basically means just put a hold on everything. Let's think about this. Let's talk about this as a nation. Let's see if we want this. Let's see if we're ready for this. And go from there. And let's just put a hold for a few years or for whatever length of time. My sense, and even in the decision from the first two applications, both decisions, the decision maker said these applications are premature. They were put in too early. There's not enough information known about the marine environment, nor the effects
apparently premature applications happen to one in five men. So,
and we go back to Vinny's jokes. Should I keep giggling with you or nah, all good?
No, we're very professional So you're going to be appearing before a select committee about this, the moratorium on seabed mining, right? Yeah. Now, for three reasons here. Basically, the regulation process is unsatisfactory, and the destruction that the mining is going to cause, as well as trying to trigger a national discussion, right? Now, the whole point of national discussion is to put a spotlight on the process itself. Now, basis do you think that is? Do you think that it's not, you know, well up in the public domain, or does everybody kind of know about this but just don't know the details?
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, it's not in the public domain. Generally speaking, there's been some media coverage from the work that we've done and other groups fighting it have done. The government itself, as far as government-initiated dialogue, national dialogue and conversation around it, there's been zero. But the government, meanwhile, the governments have been inviting these companies from overseas and to get this work done. It's about gaining more of an understanding of what exists out there in the ocean for a start, and our relationships as New Zealanders with the ocean, and whether or not we want it.
Now, in the case of Papua New Guinea, they didn't even know that it was happening there until they'd already consented to it.
Yeah, in Papua New Guinea, there is the very first application to mine the seabed has been granted in Papua New Guinea some years ago, maybe 5 years ago now. But the local communities didn't even know that it was on the cards until after it was permitted. And there was a lot of kerfuffle about, you know, the government going through it in an improper way. And the company Nautilus Minerals sort of was put on hold for a couple of years, and now the government's in a partnership with the company, but they're still on hold. So if you saw the images of the machines that they want to use down there, it's just frightening. They're just massive machines with huge teeth, just tearing the seabed up and sucking everything up.
Oh my God. That reminds me of what was that music video by Pearl Jam, Do the Evolution? And there's a part like towards the end of it where there's these giant metal snake things with massive teeth that just are scooping up the land and just gobbling it up and then just shoveling it into the machines and things like that. It's not entirely dissimilar from what we're freaking talking about, right?
No. The application off South Taranaki, so it's basically 20 kilometres off the coast of Pātia. You know, Poie, the wonderful song from the 1980s, Pātia, a small community along the coast there. That application is 50 million tonnes a year for up to 35 years. If you break that down, that's 8,000 tonnes per hour. So 8,000 tonnes, a tonne is about half a cubic metre, right? So if you think of a quarter acre section, 4 metres high, being sucked up the pipe every hour, 24/7, 365 days a year. It's a phenomenal amount of material being moved and processed. And I mean, a lot of the basis of the food web exists. I mean, in a big portion of it exists in and on the seabed. And so the 65 square kilometre area that they want to mine, that's going to be left as a dead zone. And the plume from pumping that other 90% of stuff that they don't want, that they call waste, back into the ocean, that creates a massive plume that reaches out for, there's a big issue about how big that plume will be, and we can't really verify that.
And choke the sunlight from getting to nearer to the bottom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what it is. One of the issues is so phytoplankton is the plant plankton in the ocean, and that's requires photosynthesis, which requires light. The more the light there is, the more photosynthesis can occur. And phytoplankton is the very base of the food web. It's the thing that determines how much life will be in an area.
Which means if you mess with them, you're messing with the entire ecosystem.
Indeed. And you know, like the company has said that the area they want to mine is basically a desert. There's nothing out there. There's virtually no life, da 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 da. They've done bugger all research, and the local fishermen, the local divers have identified a bunch of incredible reefs with, you know, just full-on diversity of life existing on these reefs just inshore from the mining site. We've got a marine mammals expert that's just been out there for the last two summers researching blue whales, and I don't know if you've seen that recent footage that's come out, but there was footage from last year that drone footage of a mother and baby, mother and calf pair, blue whale pair, and the stationary in this beautiful glassy blue day, and the calf just slips under the mother and starts suckling, you know, and then slips back out, and then the footage which was released yesterday shows that the blue whales, the way they feed is incredible, and it shows actually the blue whale diving for a big clump of zooplankton that, you know, that they feed on, krill, I should say, and just incredible. So she was out on the water for 9 days this January, February, and she saw 68 different individual blue whales over 31 sightings, and that's all in vicinity, not in the actual mining site, but within hearing range of the operation. And, you know, noise is a big concern for marine mammals. A constant humming drone of noise for 35 years with pretty high decibel levels. And so, you know, the South Taranaki Bight, which is the big bit of water that runs from Cape Taranaki, Cape Egmont, down the coast towards Wellington, Kapiti and Wellington, and then across the top of the South Island, that's like a bit of a bowl, if you look at it, it's a bowl on its side opening out to the west, and the Cook Strait is, it sort of resembles the drain, and that body of water is a large area of water, but it hosts possibly the largest, the biggest diversity of marine mammals anywhere in the world.
And they want to strip mine it.
They want to strip mine it. it's crazy. It's bizarre, you know.
Everybody goes like, "Oh, how can those people sleep at night?" just taking a stab in the dark. They don't have a conscience to keep them up. You know,
yeah. So
hey, man, can we make some more money tomorrow? Absolutely, we can. Do we have to lie through our teeth? And
but you know, okay. So early on in the hearing in February when we were in Wellington, the CEO of the company he got up and had, you know, told his side of the story, and to his credit, he was pretty open and. And I thanked him for that. But he basically said, you know, we want to see this as a big industry in New Zealand. And we're at the front end of the wedge.
The thin
end of the wedge. And if we gain consent here, we're going to apply for another application right next door. Plus we're going to apply for another application up near Kawhia. And so, you know, they've got big plans and the area in Kawhia that they want to mine is smack dab in the middle of the Maui's dolphin habitat, and it's right near shore, which is exactly where they hang out. They hang out generally closer to shore. Sometimes they go out into deeper waters, and they do go all the way down to Whanganui. But this is off Kawhia, is really close to the center of their habitat. And he's just like, it's not even in his consciousness that the world's most critically endangered marine mammal, the Maui dolphin, is in the area that he wants to screw up.
The old saying is that if you give a mouse a cookie, he's going to want a glass of milk.
Indeed.
And if we are the thin end of the wedge here, then not only is it important for New Zealanders themselves to get on this in terms of their own environment, but it's important for us to stop it here so that it sets a precedent to be stopped everywhere potentially, right? Because ultimately, when you have a look at the costs to the environment, the ecosystem, and so on and so forth, not to mention the very pittance that the government and thereby the people will get out of it, there is actually nothing in it for anybody apart from those at the other end clipping the ticket. That means the people lose out, the animals lose out, the environment loses out, and we don't economically benefit from it really any.
Hmm.
So no reasons whatsoever to actually have it. Now I hear that the Origin Energy Oil and Gas Company is opposing it. The fishing industry is opposing it. You know?
Yep. So to go back to your comment around precedent setting, so those first two applications that came in, they were essentially the first two in the Western world, in the developed world, first two applications, right? And both of them got declined. So that threw shockwaves through the whole, you know, through shockwaves within New Zealand, but also internationally, you know. You're right. It is important that we set a good example, for the rest of the world to follow. The world views New Zealand in a certain way that, you know, we are full of wild places and we look after those wild places and we are a relatively conscious population, environmentally conscious and socially responsible. But this sort of thing just completely flies in the face of that. And it's good that we've had two applications declined. And if we're, you know, the other thing in the current application, they've extended the time frame, so the hearing was supposed to end around the 20th of March, on the 18th of March, the decision-making committee said, actually, we're going to run this through till the 31st of May. So it's akin to, you know, playing a hard-out game of soccer and then as extra time, instead of that 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, they say, let's play another 120 minutes. You know,
it's a sudden death round, bro.
but then in that order that they put out, they said, okay, you guys, TTR, the company, you guys can pull on a couple of fresh players as well, and actually we'll help you get some of your work done. You know, it's pretty bizarre, but up to the reason they did that. Absolutely, the reason they did that was because the company was on the ropes. There's no way, with all the evidence that was heard over the sort of 5 or 6 week hearing time, all the evidence that was heard, there's no way that the EPA could grant consent. So they basically had said, we're going to extend it. We're going to give them an opportunity to get more information in front of us so that we can justify granting consent, because right now we can't, you know.
Based upon everything we've seen, we can't justify our actions. So we need further time to justify them. All right, what are you going to do, bro? Like have a confab and just make up some kind of fictional plume of facts, you know?
Yeah, it's bizarre.
Well, that's what happens when you're dealing with a corrupt process, unfortunately, and it's something New Zealanders are really. We're unaware of how corrupted our process is. Like, we're so unaware that we don't even know what corruption even looks like or sounds like. Mm. Now, it seems to me that the process by which to be followed is, you know, the set amount of time for submissions, and then there's a cutoff point. Oh, you haven't got your exam in on time. I'm sorry.
That's not allowed anymore. It's called rules, and we follow them, and we don't bend them for nobody.
That's kind of how I was taught, you know, school and government and all of those organizations are supposed to work. But if you've got, for some reason, an incredible amount of destruction that you want to wrought on the New Zealand people.
Oh, bro, real, you need some extra time. Here you go. I know, just between us, you know, like, just don't tell anybody that we made this special fucking exception just for you.
I mean, the other side of it, DOC, the Department of Conservation, they engaged in the first application. This application, they met with the company. They said this, that, and the other, and then they put in a statement saying we're not going to engage because we don't think that any further conservation gains can be achieved through engaging. So DOC basically gave it the green light. And this is, you know, this, I mean, blue whales, Maui dolphin, and a number of other species that exist in the area, and DOC's not even part of the process. MBIE, the Ministry for...
This is the same DOC that allows monofluoroacetate compound 1080 to be dumped into our rivers and native bushlands and things like that, which can take up to 24 to 36 hours for an animal to die writhing in agony. So I wouldn't give their say-so too much credence.
Well, you know, like I can say straight up, in the last process, they did a reasonable job in pointing to some issues that they had with it, and so all I can say here is that there is downward pressure on the people within DOC, and I've met lots of good people working within DOC. They've got issues in relation to lack of funding, but in this case, it wasn't about lack of funding. It was just, we don't want to get in the way of this application process. We don't want to obstruct it. And they would have had to obstruct it had they engaged. And then on the other side, MBIE, the Ministry for Business, Innovation and Enterprise, as well as MPI, the Ministry for Primary Industries, they both support the application. And they say, we want, you know, MBIE said, we want to develop an extraction industry for the minerals that exist in our marine estate. And You know, that's just straight up. They came out and said that in the hearing. And, yeah, pretty bizarre. You mentioned earlier about Origin Energy and the fishing industry. So the fishing industry has opposed all three applications and done so strongly as well, and thrown some money at providing experts and legal people to fight it. And that's basically around, you know, they've got existing rights there. They've got their extraction of massive amounts of fish, and this would create an exclusion zone for an area. Plus, it basically undermines the health of the oceans. And if the oceans are less healthy, there's less fish, and therefore there's less opportunity for them to catch fish. And less money at the end of the day. So they've engaged the Origin Energy, which runs the Kupe platform in South Taranaki. That platform is about 1.5 kilometres from the proposed mining site. So, and they've also got areas in the proposed mining site that they want to potentially tap for oil as well. So there's a conflict, spatial conflict there where these two permits overlap. And so they've been fighting it as well, and they basically said, you know, we're talking with the company, we're trying to work through conditions that might be acceptable, but basically we don't want them there. They're an added risk to our billion-dollar infrastructure that exists there. If a big storm comes and moves one of the ships off their sort of tether to the seafloor and smashes it into our rig, we're in big trouble, and we're talking big financial trouble and big ecological trouble with a potential spill. So there's all these different sort of things that haven't really been ironed out as far as existing interests. And then of course, iwi has put up a massive fight as well. So Ngāti Rūnui in Hāwera Pātea area, they host in their area the biggest number of oil wells and gas wells and that sort of thing. So they're highly experienced in dealing with companies of this type, and they've come out and said this company has not consulted with us properly. They're not even getting past first base, and they want to make a home run, you know. And culturally, it's just so offensive because it's just so destructive. They've put up a big fight. And culturally, it's from a Māori perspective, it appears that it's very offensive. But from an ocean lover, Pākehā community member, it's also just beyond what we can accept. It's just not okay. So there's lots of things.
Okay, well, basically it appears to me that it's ordinary people defending their livelihood against major multinational corporations. You know, tale as old as time, since the days of Beauty and the Beast, and she'll be right. Now, CASM is a volunteer organization. I understand that you guys have been hiring lawyers and scientists to do some of the work, and there's costs involved with running the website, feeding the volunteers, so on and so forth. So, chasm.org.nz, chasm.org.nz is the website, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go and flick them a few bucks. And, you've got that, got your hearings coming up, bro. Are you nervous?
Well, no, we've been in the hearings since February and it's on hold at the moment, but we'll be going back in a couple of weeks for the last week or so. No, I'm not nervous. It's just it's another day. Getting kind of used to it these days after the third time around. On our website, there's lots of information about what I've talked about. You can follow us. You can become a member of our incorporated society. You can support us financially, which would be really helpful. It's costing us tens of thousands of dollars to pay the experts that work for us and all of us that are working voluntarily on it. We have expenses in relation to travel and accommodation and stuff. So every single dollar helps.
All right. Thank you very much, Phil McCabe from chasm.org.nz, protecting the seabed like a blue whale would protect her calf from a wily seabed mining shark.
Yes, right.
It is destruction of the environment, the ecosystem, and the human race, and all of the other organisms on the planet, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't mean we have to take it too seriously. And also remember that this is a listener-supported broadcast as well. So go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, like, go ahead, make my news. And give us a dollar a month through Patreon there, or a couple of dollars a month through the Kiwi Bank or the PayPal, whichever way is easiest for you to support me, so I can support all the people just like Phil and the other ones who the mainstream media don't want to give an hour of airtime to. Bye-bye.
American.
Practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much
radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys, because they have all the technology, they have all these great things that they're gonna do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion, because they're a do-it-yourself radio network, and we just need that so much.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel, for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does.
Well, they never censor, hung up, or cut off their guests.
Well, that's no fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shills and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative mainstream and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
No rules. No rules. No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are.
We are.
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.